Welcome back to Out of the Hourglass. I'm your podcast host, Molly Nolan, and today we are doing something a little bit different. I am taking a back seat, and instead we are sharing an excerpt from our keynote presentation at our Grand Summit conference in Savannah last month. The theme of the conference was Build Your Inner Citadel. If you're not sure what a citadel is, think of a fortress, a castle, a structure that is built for war, it's built for battle, is built to be bulletproof. We want our clients and you out there listening to look at your organization that way. How can you build your organization to be bulletproof? To be prepared to expect the battles in a way that you're prepared to win them. There are 7 fortifications that Brian Nolan and Colin Nolan shared as they took the stage in Savannah. Today, you're going to hear about 4 of the 7 fortifications in this excerpt. Of course, if you'd like to learn more, you want to hear what the other 3 are, please reach out. But in the meantime, we encourage you to think hard about your organization as you listen to this excerpt and you think about building your own inner citadel. This episode is brought to you by the Sherwin-Williams Company, our premier Grand Summit sponsor and a supporting partner of the Summit member group.
Castles, like these shields, were made for safety and defense. They're beautiful, but the spires, the location high up, the walls made them hard to get to. Impregnable, some would say. Some castles had weaknesses, Achilles' heels. One such castle was called Chateau Galliard in Los Angeles, France. At that time, this castle was actually, the whole land was British land. The French had not yet had that land. And so the British had this castle, and it was high up. It was built by Richard the Lionheart, and it was to defend this land. But it had an Achilles heel, like some businesses. In 1204, just to go back to this one, this is why it was so good. It had double walls, it had intricate defense features, it had high spires, it was impregnable, like the builder Richard the Lionheart. The Achilles heel, though, lay in the well, in the water supply. You see, the well was fed by the river. And the British held in 1204 as the French attacked. And they held and they held, and then the French got an idea. They said, let's divert the river away and take the water out of the well. And the British eventually, the morale and the water was gone. And since then, it was like domino. France became France, and the British left. They lost all of that land because of an Achilles heel. It makes me wonder, what's your Achilles heel? What architectural features can you put in place to protect your inner citadel? Oh, we could have called it a fortress, but that wouldn't have been as much fun. And kept you guys curious. It's a citadel. You see, the problem is this. We don't prepare for what we don't see in the moment. The Titanic sure didn't. The Titanic was focused on speed. The unsinkable Titanic, the hubris of the unsinkable Titanic, asked the 1,500 souls the bottom of the sea if it was unsinkable, focused on speed. Like many businesses, I hear so much about top line. How much revenue are you going to do? How much revenue? What I'm interested in first is how much profit you're going to do, in the strength of your systems, in the reserves that you have to prepare. It's kind of like we don't want to go to the doctor because we don't want to find out what we may have. Ever have that thought? what happened here? I still remember the 2007 Grand Summit. Where's Andrew, my coach? Andrew was here, 2007 in Chicago. The two of us gave out 80 Texas Instruments. Calculators were big back then. Phones didn't have these things on them. And we were doing benchmarking, and we said, we want you all to imagine you lost a quarter of your business. We just had a feeling something was coming. But in 2007, who would bet against the housing market? You know what happened? They gave me all these back. I had these all over my house. People gave me these back because they said, we want to focus on growth. It's about growth. And what did happen? Well, these gentlemen here in The Big Short, they bet against the housing market and they won. They shortened mortgage securities and they won. And then what happened next? Lehman Brothers, out of business, September 2008. Bear Stearns would follow soon after. My business lost a third of its business, but we survived. People think that Summit is about growth. Maybe because it's like the mountain and Summit and growth. But for me, it's always been about creating a legacy. It's always been about bulletproof. It's always been about being able to pass it on to your kids someday. It's been about not needing a bank. Oh, you may use a bank, but you don't have to need a bank. Kevin Nolan always talked about this. He always said, don't need a bank now, Bri. And that is awesome. You use them, but you don't need them. It is about having cash flow, never having to miss payroll, never having to worry about payroll. That's bulletproof. It's about having systems that are capable, consistent, and capable, and performed by all your people, and they know who they are, so you don't have problems. It's about picking the kind of jobs you want and the customers you want, so you don't get buried in terrible jobs and terrible customers who don't pay. And it's about a budget as a standard, not a guideline, that is cascaded down all the way. That's bulletproof. With due credit to this bulletproof concept goes the R.J. Forbes team. Where's my good friend Ross Forbes? Yeah, Ross Forbes is a buddy of mine, long-term member. Not a call goes by where Ross says, how we doing, Bri? Are we bulletproof? Are we bulletproof yet? I love it so much because Ross has been through sieges. Ross has built things and he's lost things and he's built things back up again. And you know what he's doing? He's teaching his kids the importance of bulletproof. You can find an app, you can find in the app a dashboard that will show you the measurements R.J. Forbes looks at all the time. That's the legacy Ross is going to leave his family. Now, people may think we're at war now. They may think, well, leads are down, it's war now. Well, it's not like 2008, and we need to begin to fortify now. So let's go back to our castle reference. How fortified is your castle? Colin is going to talk to you about one of the strongest, most recognizable, and powerful castles ever built. Colin.
All right. Thank you, Brian. So let's talk about a great castle. For those of you who have been to Edinburgh in Scotland, you'll know what an unbelievable presence this castle is. It stands 430 feet above the sea, on top of a 300 million year old extinct volcano, smack dab in the center of Edinburgh. It is the most besieged castle in all of Europe and potentially the world. A fortification has existed on top of this extinct volcano since 800 BC, so the Iron Age. And while it was always a fortification, it wasn't turned into a true castle that we know of today until around 1300, when the Scottish king, King David II, really fortified it. And a part of that construction included building what was known as King David's Tower. For its time, a massive, imposing tower that safeguarded the whole city. So for 200 years, this castle and this tower safeguarded Edinburgh until something called the Lang Siege, which was a two-year-long siege. You see, the castle in 1300 was built before the real advent and use of cannons and gunpowder. So when that came along, during the two-year-long siege, the castle and the tower was pummeled day after day until after the 2 years, it was rubble. So what did the people of Edinburgh and Scotland do when their most formidable defense was completely obliterated? They rebuilt it immediately. They spent the next 40-some-odd years reconstructing, refortifying Edinburgh Castle, building much of what we see here today. That top half-moon-shaped thing, the curvature up the top, is called the half-moon battery, which housed 9 cannons. So they use cannons now. They learn from their mistakes. And I think about this story, and over 40 years to reconstruct this thing, the sacrifice, the resources that this took. And I think back to the concept that humans have the ability to pull together and work towards common goals, worthwhile goals. Think of the great cathedrals of Europe that took centuries to construct, like Notre Dame in the center of Paris, took 200 years to build. The architect and the builders that broke ground on Notre Dame in 1163 knew that they would never see the finished product. Their kids would never see the finished product. Their kids' kids would likely never see the finished product. The ability to gear your actions towards long-term benefit, towards steeling oneself, towards preparing for things to come, for me, is a fascinating topic. There have been 48 recessions in the United States since 1781. That's one every roughly 5 to 6 years. Edinburgh Castle was besieged 23 times in its roughly 500-some-odd year history, where it was really used as a defensive structure. After each and every siege, the people of Edinburgh and Scotland looked to their defenses, sought out the weaknesses, and got about refortifying, sometimes over the course of decades. They knew the next siege was coming. Maybe not next year, maybe not in 20 years, but one day they would need that strong castle. Many people in this room, as Brian mentioned, were around in 2008 when their proverbial King David's Tower was destroyed. We know sieges can happen. We know it may not happen next year. And a siege could be anything. It could be the economy going bad, demand dropping. It could be a lawsuit. It could be employee issues, your best person leaving. There are sieges come in many different ways, shapes, and forms. But what we're passionate about is fortifying oneself, fortifying your business, and fortifying your inner citadel to prepare for whatever comes your way. We've identified 7 different fortifications in your business that, if fortified, give yourself and your business and your people the best shot possible of surviving and thriving after the next siege. They are: planning as a core function. Is this something that you do haphazardly? Yep, it's January, let's start planning. Or is it something that you do as one of the best things your company does? Financial strength, how strong is your balance sheet? Is it fortified? Relationship development, are we calling on friends and relationships when times are bad, or are we out there prospecting in the middle of June when times are good? Operational excellence, when the next siege comes, are we fighting with the tip of the spear, or are we doing too many things that we're not passionate about or operationally excellent at? Safety, is it really a priority in your companies? Leadership development, not a new concept, but something that people don't take the time to do every day. And last is culture, the glue that kind of keeps it all together. In your workbooks, on page 13, we have this exercise that we're going to do over the course of the next 45 some odd minutes. As we go through each of these seven in detail, after we're done, we're going to ask you to rank yourself and your business on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being, this is my weakest fortification, it is crumbling, I wouldn't hold up to a siege, with 10 being, this is my Edinburgh castle, you can besiege me 23 times here, and I'm going to come out fighting on the other side. Brian.
For 34 years, I've been trying to make planning a core function in companies. When I say core, it's something you do every day. A core function is estimating, it's setting up a job, it's invoicing, it's job costing. You do it again and again and again. In 1998, I worked for a company called Core. It was a public company, NASDAQ. Every quarter, we had shareholder calls, and if we didn't meet the earnings per share number, we fell. So we had a core planning process. I still remember, we called it the CPP at that time, for continuing planning process. Now, Nolan Consulting has a cascading planning process, because we want every employee, and you've heard me say this, this is my passion, to have a line of sight to that vision. And so it starts with a vision each year, then we have an annual plan, then we have a quarterly plan, you have your budget, you have your development plans for your people. But it starts with your vision, right? I want to talk about a guy that had a vision. Those of us who run know Roger Bannister. In 1954, he did what no man thought possible. He broke the 4-minute mile record. For decades, people were trying to break this. It was thought impossible to break it. In fact, it had held at 401 for 12 years. And then one man had a vision to say that if you mentally prepare, if you visualize success, you can overcome obstacles and you can do it. And so he did it in 359.4. What happened next? 5 weeks later, it was broken again. Then again and again and again, month after that, the record is now 343. What, did humans all of a sudden become superhuman? No, one man had a vision to break it, and he did. So you guys know we're about visioning success first. Everybody in this room, if you're a sales rep, visualize success, hitting your goal. If you're a field person, visualize productivity, safety, and leadership. This man had a goal. This man had a vision. This is Colin Nolan. Oh, it was serious, okay. So he's all by himself, but there was a whole crowd behind him, you see. He didn't break the 7-minute mile, but he did what's known as a beer mile. How does that work? Well, you guzzle a beer, a whole beer, you do a quarter mile. You guzzle another beer, a quarter mile, another beer, a quarter mile, another beer. He did it in 701. Who here can run a mile in 701? I'm so proud of him.
Thanks, Dad.
Well, he was so proud of himself. You should have seen him. Well, he actually beat his cousin, which was part of the fun. I researched the best planning event that ever happened. That's pretty intense, right? You know what came up? D-Day. June 6, 1944. 150,000 Allied troops invading Normandy to free France from Germany. 7,000 ships, 13,000 airplanes invading. The planning that went into this was unbelievable. They actually did what we now call a pre-mortem. Remember a pre-mortem from last year? You plan for every eventuality, what could go wrong. Different landing sites, reserve troops. Oh, they were ready, and it worked, and we freed them. I actually had the great privilege in 2018 of biking down Normandy and getting off at Omaha Beach. Now, many of you are doing planning in a great way. Jonathan Davey, is Jonathan here? Nice, Jonathan. Jonathan recently came to a first ascent, and dude, you wowed me. I was talking about the importance of planning, like I do often, and I could just see him like perking up. And I said, Jonathan, can you tell us how you and your partner, Kevin, plan? And he talked about rocket fuel. He said, well, I'm the integrator, Kevin's a visionary, and we have annual meetings, we have quarterly meetings, we have monthly meetings. It's rocket fuel. It's not rocket science, it's rocket fuel. Between 2012 and 2008, they doubled in business many times, and he attributes much of that to the planning that they do. Steve Talkington, you're a planner. Steve once said to me, Bri, if you ever stop doing my 90-day plan, we're done. So I don't stop doing that. This is their team that they plan with. And I think about team because I've got a quote that I have my business card on. It says, lead with vision. Where there is no vision, the people will perish. It's on my desk, and I wonder how many people would be there if you didn't have that vision. Okay, this is the first rating of yourself. Rate yourself from 1 to 10. Is planning a core function in your business? The vision thing, it's real. Let's make sure you do that. Give yourself a score. At the end, we're going to ask a few brave souls to share their scores. Colin for number 2.
The second fortification, financial strength. Who remembers Circuit City? Hands. Okay, I remember Circuit City because Circuit City was the first job I ever had. Just a 16-year-old slinging TVs, living the dream. I could sell plasmas, LCDs, you name it. That's probably why they failed, but. In reality, the reason why Circuit City failed is pretty well documented and established. It's one of the most case studies in many business schools. They had things like terrible location choices with no foot traffic. They had an awful inventory system, the kind that would make our lean guy Jim have nightmares. And they fired the majority, sometime in the mid-2000s, they fired the majority of their senior staff that were really high paid. And they hired minimum wage workers that were 16 years old to sell their most high value product. I was not the employee of the year in 2007, but I could push those plazas, baby. You should have seen me in my heyday. So the reason why Circuit City failed is well documented, but I think that the point that encapsulates their failure was their lack of financial strength and little to no financial discipline. And in order to get more into that, we need to get into a different company real quick. CarMax. I think everyone knows CarMax, right? I bought my car from CarMax 2015. It's got 100,000 miles on it now. Great car. Toyota Camry. So CarMax, believe it or not, was started inside of Circuit City. It was part of the company. Just was crazy when I learned that. It's a car company. Why would Circuit City start it? Well, at one point, Circuit City was doing some pretty smart things, apparently. So in 1993, Circuit City executives started CarMax from scratch inside of Circuit City, and over the next 10 years, it blew up. Into the late 90s, early 2000s, it was on an upward trajectory. It was crushing it. It was the first real used car company that there was no haggling, the sticker price was the sticker price. They did a crazy inspection to make sure there were no lemons. It was a novel concept, and they were doing great. So in 2003, when the economy was booming, the Circuit City board and the executives, they decided to spin CarMax out into its complete own company that would trade under its own ticker on the New York Stock Exchange, complete separation. So this resulted in a massive cash influx into Circuit City. Their balance sheet was great. And this was at a time when Circuit City was, again, doing okay, but right on the cusp before they started to go downhill. So that was 2003. What did they do with the massive cash influx that they got from CarMax? They blew it all. They spent over $1 billion over the next 4 years, 03 to 07, over $1 billion on stock buybacks. Now, stock buybacks are not in and of themselves an awful thing. Almost every company does them. But it's about when you do them. It's about the timing. It's about making sure your balance sheet is fortified before chasing greed, before chasing short-term stock rallies. That's what they were doing. And they were blowing all this money as their business kept going further and further downhill. Their stores needed to be redesigned. They probably shouldn't have fired all of their senior staff to save money. They made terrible financial decisions. When the stock buybacks started in 2003, the share price for Circuit City was trading at $8 a share. In 2008, when Circuit City's stock was halted on the stock exchange because they were clearly going out of business, it was trading at 10 cents a share. So they effectively lit $1 billion on fire. It's gone. Money that no one will ever see again. Coming at the cost of 30-some thousand jobs. Fortunately, I was on to bigger and better things by that point. So let's take a look at a company that had an exact opposite experience heading into the Great Recession and beyond it, so Costco. So Costco, I know you're thinking, Colin, it's a big discount chain that, of course, would survive a recession. That's where everybody would go. And to some extent, you're right. But it's not that they survived the Great Recession. It's that the moves they were able to make during the Great Recession is what set them on the trajectory that they eventually went on to become the behemoth that they are today. So Costco has always been known in the financial world as being extremely disciplined. They always keep their balance sheet extremely strong. Always a ton of cash on hand. So going into the Great Recession, they were positioned really well. This allowed them to take complete advantage of their environment where other businesses were floundering, like Circuit City. It allowed them to begin buying at discount really premium goods, goods that they formerly had never sold. Goods that now people joined Costco to buy there, brought in a whole new customer base. They were the only bulk retailer to not lay off a single employee during the entire Great Recession. Not a single employee was laid off. Think about the retraining costs, the rehiring costs, the brain drain that they didn't suffer from as a result of their balance sheet. And perhaps best of all, they were able to really double down and use this time to invest in their in-house brand, Kirkland Signature. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Kirkland, it's the Costco brand that produces significantly higher margins for them, crazy profit. Anything you can buy at Costco, you can basically buy a Kirkland Signature version of. So toiletries, pet supplies, toilet paper, food, but best of all, clothing. When Brian's not wearing Summit swag, he is exclusively dressed in Kirkland clothing.
It's true. It's true.
I recently caught him about a month ago. He's getting his 2024 spring collection. God, the shirts were only $11.99. Can you believe it? I guess not. So let's take these examples and let's bring them down into the Summit world. And I want to talk about someone with extreme financial discipline, Josh Crothers. So Josh Crothers, right now, is in the middle of a siege, a three-headed siege. He is experiencing a drop in demand in his market. He's experiencing operational issues resulting in decreased profits. and he's recently come under wage pressure from his field, resulting in unplanned raises. So the three of these things are really causing him some problems. Prior to these last 6 to 8 months, Prescott Landscaping was on a rocket ship. They were crushing it. They were routinely growing at a clip of 20-some-odd% every year. Their operating profits were in the high teens, up to 20%. They were doing great. But Josh was never a prisoner of the moment. He always kept an extremely strong balance sheet. He was extremely disciplined. He always had 30 days cash on hand in his operating account, and he at all times had 3 months of overhead in his reserves. It is this financial discipline, this strength of his financial fortification, that is going to allow him to survive the current siege he is in. A siege that would have put many other businesses out of business and forced them to declare bankruptcy. So takeaways. My grandfather always said, never take a risk you can't cover. Always have enough cash on hand to cover the worst case scenario of a chosen strategy. Understand the effect that growth has on cash, model it out, know what's coming, see ahead, and make the difficult decisions. When times are good, focus on long-term benefit. Focus on a long-term plan. What will I wish I did 5 years from now? Make the tough decisions when times are good, so when times are bad, you have more freedom and you can operate like Costco. You can take advantage of the environment around you. So on a scale of 1 to 10 in your books, give yourself a ranking. 1, financial fortification is weak. 10 being, I got over 30 days cash on hand. I got strong reserves.
All right, let's talk about the toughest system in Summit for us coaches to get you to all do. I'm talking about relationship development. You may call it business development. You may call it prospecting. But we know it's about relationships, don't we? It is the hardest thing. Oh, we started in January because we don't have any leads, but that's too late. You got to do it during peacetime. Ever hear of the 30-day rule, fanatical prospecting? The 30-day rule says the things you do in these 30 days will impact you 90 days down the road. The time to start was in the summer and the fall. But I'm going to show you a rock star. Her name is Jacqueline Rogers. There she is. Jacqueline Rogers believes in what she calls organic authenticity. Go to her LinkedIn page. It says, creating and cultivating lasting relationships. She came to AI Painting Plus with no really outside sales experience, but she knew how to build relationships. She spends half of her time doing this. She joined a B&I group shortly after she was president of it. She joined the chamber and became an ambassador. She's in many other groups now. She says it's uncomfortable, Bri, but sometimes you just got to do it. And it is a wonderful example. I had a chance to talk to her down at the PCA, and I was like, that's it. And Tim, she's sitting right behind you, so osmosis here, good stuff. What Jacqueline is doing is she's building a relational flywheel, relational capital, that for years will spin off leads and work authentically. It's this concept of relational capital that I'm intrigued with. When I work with sales reps, I like to say, hey, give me a list of 30 to 50 people in your circle of influence. I was talking with Jake Est about this last night from Albright. He's doing this. Give me a list. Now tell me how much money is in this list. And oh, by the way, it is a privilege to be on your list. Why is it a privilege? Because you are going to first care about them. You see, you're building what's called the circle of influence. I'm just going to take a minute to explain this because I said earlier it is the hardest system. I need this to be a system, guys, So we survive the next siege that happens. It starts with, who are my targets on the outside? And then I have acquaintances. And then eventually they become established and I get raving fans. And I know their goals, their passions, and their struggles. And I authentically care about the people in my circle. That's why if people aren't getting back to me, they don't deserve to be on my list, because to be on my list is special. I don't know if some of you have noticed, but I follow this system. Many of you are my friends. I look at Josh and Paul and Chuck and Steve and George and Ross and David. I feel like it's the Oscars. I don't want to miss anybody. But it is about as authentic as you can get. They know you can call me on a Sunday and we'll be there. And I know you will care about me. You will refer our business. It is the way. It is the way to go through business. So you sales reps out there, don't willy-nilly prospect. Focus on, and it's fun. It's the way to do this. This needs to become a core function. So I ask you, what is the cause of sales? What's the cause? What's the cause of sales? Relationships is the cause of sales. Your takeaway, relationship causes sales. Please rate yourself on the Citadel Castle. How systematized, trackable in your sales meetings? Are we holding people accountable? It's so vital.
Operational excellence. All right. As Molly said earlier, this is going to be a bit of a history lesson, so bear with me here for the next like 5 minutes, okay? I want us to teleport back. Let's get in our time machines. Teleport back to World War I. Not World War II, World War I. So 1914, World War I breaks out for very silly reasons. The German military is the strongest military in the world. And many historians would argue one of the strongest militaries in the history of the world at the time. Fast forward to 1917. This invincible German military is 2.5 years into the costliest human conflict in the history of the world to that point. They are fighting a two-front war, and they're not doing very well. See, World War I devolved into trench warfare, as many of you will know, where these sides dug in and didn't move for years. And you would do these massive wave attacks and counterattacks, and you would spend thousands and millions of lives just to gain 100 yards. It was ridiculous and crazy. So in the winter of 1617, the German high command, they knew they needed to do something. We are losing this war. So they had an extremely counterintuitive idea that ended up being brilliant. They removed the front line on the Western Front and moved it back miles and miles and miles. They wanted to pull all of their troops off the front line. So they spent 6 months rebuilding the Western Front, building what was dubbed the Hindenburg Line. That's the general that was the brainchild behind it. You see, what ended up happening in World War I is when you would do these attacks and counterattacks over the years, the front line was not this neat thing that you could just etch on a map. It was this weird, squiggly, Frankenstein front line that didn't make any sense. And you would attack and hold on to this land because land was valuable, but it was bad land and you were just defending it because it was land that you got. Every inch was contested, so why would we give it up? So one morning in the spring of 1917, once the new front line was already done, the entire military was gone the next day. That's what, if you've seen the movie 1917, that's what's depicted. The Allies were flabbergasted. They were just gone. After 2.5 years, the German military that had been harassing them was just gone. It was ludicrous at the time. So why did they do it? Number one, they were able to pick their battles. They picked the best land to defend, the high ground, on the other side of difficult bodies of water to cross, They knew where they wanted to make their stand. But the best part was, remember the line, the front line was this weird squiggly line before? They straightened it out. They were able to cut 25 miles off the entire front line. They shortened it. What did this do? It allowed them to save 15 divisions of soldiers, remove them from the front line. 150,000 men were now able to be put elsewhere. This new front line, the Hindenburg Line, proved impenetrable for a year and a half until the U.S. got involved and the resources were just overwhelming, and it did eventually fall. But it extended the war and gave them their best shot. All right, so Colin, thanks for the history lesson. What does this have to do with me? Well, it's natural in life, in business, in war, that when you're successful, you keep pushing. You try new things. Let's open up a different division. Let's hire this person to try something new. Let's start working with new customers. We want to expand and keep conquering. Sometimes it's a success and it works out. Sometimes it doesn't. The issue is not that we fail. Failure is a part of growth. It's a part of life. The issue is that we fail and that we double down and we keep going. And we end up holding on to types of work. We end up holding on to divisions in our companies that are difficult to defend, that we should be giving up. We end up holding on to people that we've invested so much time in, that they're just missing that one or two things from making them a great employee. We're holding on to customers we should be giving up, that make up a lot of our revenue, but might be a really difficult customer to work with and never pay on time. We need to reassess where we are operationally excellent and pour our passion into it. I think of operational excellence in Summit. I think of Brian Stauffer sitting right here. So I spoke with Brian Stauffer a few months ago, and he has incredible stories. So he started his business in 2011, landscaping business. They were doing mowing as well. And by 2016, the mowing division of his company was fully fledged. It was going to be a massive part of his future. It was about 20%, give or take, of his total company revenue. But as the years went on, and Brian began to audit the mowing, and he began to look under the hood, he found out a couple things. Number one, the revenue per hour on the mowing division was half of what it was elsewhere. The profit was not where it needed to be. It was never going to be the most profitable thing in the world, but the idea was they would cash flow the other divisions. But the profit was just not even enough to sustain it. And then worst of all, over 80%, sometimes up to 100%, of his negative customer interactions, the negative reviews he got, the phone calls into the office, all stemmed from the mowing division. So Brian struggled with this decision, but he eventually, in 2022, decided to shut down the mowing division entirely. He sold what equipment he could. He had just purchased brand new equipment the year before. He had over $100,000 of brand new equipment in the mowing division, sold it. He found other competitors to take on contracts that he still had, and he had to let go of his employees in that division. He did all of this in the middle of June, by the way, middle of the season. But he knew that he needed to pour himself into where he was operationally excellent. He had competitors coming by that saw him selling his equipment, and they thought he was going out of business. And once they figured out he was just closing down the mowing division, one of them called him crazy. We have to mow. We're landscapers. But Brian knew a couple things. He knew that he only needed 2 to 3 hardscape jobs to replace the loss in revenue. He knew that he would no longer be dealing with the massive amounts of headaches from upset customers. The negative interactions would be gone, and he would be able to pour himself into where he was operationally excellent. And it was in this conversation with Brian that I was reminded of our own operational excellence story. We used to have a call center. This is our call center on the last day of operation. It wasn't this big. I think we had like five or six at the most, but they were great. Many people in this room use the call center, but similar to Brian, it was not where our passion lied. We were not particularly gung-ho about it. It was where most of our negative issues arose from. So we made the difficult decision to close down the call center. At one point, we were called Nolan Summit Services. You guys might remember that. We were call center. I used to be a recruiter. We were going to do bookkeeping at one point. But our passion is coaching and consulting. So we consolidated, and we were focusing on where we were operationally strong. An added benefit of closing the call center is two of our most engaged, dedicated employees, who all of you know today, Deidre Ellis and Kathy Freeman, used to work in the call center, Dee almost entirely so. So they were able to devote all of their time now into the coaching world. So I was at dinner with Brian on Tuesday, and I forget what we were talking about, but he said something, a nugget of gold, he does that sometimes, that I was like, oh, this will be great. So he said, if what you were doing is not something you were passionate about, if you can't be one of the best in your area at it, and the economic situation is not viable, can't make money at it, you should not be doing it. You need all three of those ingredients. Am I passionate about it? Am I great at it? Is it economically viable? Those are the minimum requirements to play the game. Long term, right? You could try stuff short term and try and figure it out. But long term, that's where we got to go. Life is too short to not continue to double down and invest where you're passionate. And the only way you get there is by giving up what makes you weak. Pull back from the land that's hard to defend. See, I told you I would tie back. And fortify and invest where you are strong. So give yourself a ranking, 1 to 10. How operationally excellent are you? Are you fighting with the tip of the spear? So last year, a lot of you were in San Diego for Brian's keynote, and this is one of the big quotes that resonated with people. We actually have it hanging on our wall back at the office. Handle hard better, said by Carol Lawson, the basketball coach at Duke. And as I was sitting in Brian's keynote last year, and I reflected on this message of handling hard better, it kind of dawned on me that this is half the equation. You cannot wait to be faced with the hard, with life's challenges, to begin handling them better. When your business is ready and your castle is fortified, you will be able to handle the most difficult challenges that life throws your way. Because you chose this life of being a business owner, an entrepreneur, a leader of people, a person who does hard things. These are hard things. None of this is easy. But if you're going to do it with great intention, because not every castle is invincible, not every business is incapable of failure. But that does not mean you can sit around and worry and catastrophize. I really hope the economy doesn't go bad. I hope I don't lose this person. I have anxiety around the coming winter. Expect these things to happen, and you will never be surprised. Do not have anxiety. Be prepared. Because the sieges are coming, the enemy will be at the gates.
Thanks for listening to this episode.
To be ready.
Out of the Hourglass is recorded and produced by the team at Nolan Consulting Group, a nationwide business coaching and consulting firm with coaches located throughout the country. Have a question, comment, or idea for future episodes? We'd love to hear from you. Visit our website, www.nolancg.com.